How do you create something from nothing? That's the question cosmologist Lawrence Krauss asks in his new book, A Universe from Nothing. This hour, he joins us to answer the question, to talk about the past, present, and future of our universe. How did the galaxy, stars, the entire universe come to be? And why are we living at the best time to observe it? Also, the smallest exoplanets ever found, hot rocky ones, 130 light years from Earth. And you've heard about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. How about totally invincible bugs? We'll talk about a strain of tuberculosis that beats all our chemical weapons. What can we do? All that and Flora's video pick, a computer made out of bubbles. Stay with us. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. Welcome to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A few weeks ago, we talked about the discovery of new exoplanets, those planets outside of our solar system. There were the first Earth-sized exoplanets, and we had another exoplanet smack dab in the middle of the Goldilocks zone, you know, where liquid water could exist. That was another first. Well, the planet party continues, because this week, astronomers announced the discovery of the smallest exoplanet so far, again with the Kepler Space Telescope. They presented those findings at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Austin. My next guest has been reporting on the meeting all week. He's here to tell us a few bits of news about the universe. Ron Cowan is a freelance science writer for Nature and Science, among others, and you can find links to his stories at the meeting at sciencefriday.com. He joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks, Ira.
Exciting stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot of neat stuff. The exoplanet discovery, there's actually three new planets that, and they're all tinier than ever before, but the tiniest is about the size of Mars. All three of these guys orbit the same tiny dwarf star, and it's actually the most compact or miniature solar system we know about. And none of these are in the Goldilocks zone. They are all way too hot, too close to their parent star for liquid water to be there. But it's also interesting because all three of them are almost certainly rocky. They're tiny so that they probably couldn't have held on to their atmosphere if they had one. But also they're so close to their parent star that the star would have the heat from the star would have evaporated them. So they're really rocky bodies, and now we can study rocky bodies, similar in some ways to the ones in our own solar system.
Mm-hmm. So we now that we're finding these things, we're figuring out there might be a lot of rocky planets out there.
Well, that's right, because the interesting thing is that these bodies were found around red dwarf stars. These are stars half to one-sixth the size of the sun. They're the most common type of star in the Milky Way. About 80% of the stars in the Milky Way are red dwarfs. And the thinking is that if we found a few around one red dwarf, and also Kepler doesn't mostly look at red dwarfs in the first place. It looks around sun-like stars mostly. Mm-hmm. If it's already found a system like this, the astronomers are saying that our Milky Way is teeming with rocky bodies, perhaps some of them in the Goldilocks zone.
Let's talk about another story at the meeting about mapping dark matter. I thought this was really interesting, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The largest map of dark matter ever made? Is that
That's right? That's right. Now, dark matter, you know, is invisible. You can't see it. So you might think, well, how can you map it? And it's sort of, I'm going to go back to Goldilocks in a different way, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I mean, if you're one of the Three Bears and you didn't know Goldilocks was there, well, you saw your bed was broken or you saw the porridge was eaten. Well, dark matter, which makes up most of the mass in the universe but can't be seen, it has a gravitational tug. And according to Einstein, light from a distant object, like a galaxy, as it passes near one of these big, massive clumps of dark matter, will get bent and the image will look distorted. So they looked at images of 10 million galaxies across four different parts of the universe, and they statistically found a whole lot of distortions of these images. They could not account for these distortions by an ordinary matter. There wasn't enough of it. So they therefore mapped the location of the dark matter, how they clumped together. This is important because we believe that dark matter is really what brought most of the visible mass together in the universe to form galaxies like the one we live in. Mm-hmm. So this is a way to make visible the invisible. It's also neat because dark matter is thought to be made of some exotic particles. We don't know what they're made of. The more we can at least map how they clump together, that's, and things like that, is more of a clue to what they might be made of.
Mm-hmm. And does it tell us anything about that spooky dark energy stuff that's all out
there? This is really just about dark matter. Okay. I mean, it has to fit into the overall rubric that dark matter is a certain percentage of the mass energy of the universe. But no, this is really, as I understand it, just about dark matter itself. Mm-hmm. But it's the largest one, and it's also matching what the computer simulations that theorists have done for years. So they believe they're on the right track for how the universe formed and how galaxies formed.
That's always delightful when the actual facts match the theory.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
especially in physics.
That's right. This is such exotic stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There was one study that was looking at the nature of space-time. Right?
Right.
Tell us about that.
So, yeah, and this is a little bit more complicated. And this has to do with gravity, but in a different way. So the other forces of nature, like electromagnetism, like the force that holds protons and neutrons together in an atom, the so-called strong force and another type of force, they have all been united with quantum theory. But gravity has not. And the other thing you should know is that according to Einstein, gravity is actually a geometric theory that we can replace the idea of gravity by just saying space-time is curved, mm-hmm. and it's more curved where there's more gravity. Mm-hmm. So some people think, in order to unify gravity with quantum theory, that space-time itself has to be quantized. It has to be grainy on some tiny, tiny scale. And if that's true, certain wavelengths of light, which are the highest, correspond to the highest energy photons of light, might bump into this graininess and might be slowed down by it. Whereas photons of lower energy would not, because they're longer wavelength and it's like, a bowl in a china shop or something. A big guy wouldn't see these tiny little grains. So basically, several people looked at what's called a gamma ray burst, which is a short-lived event. It's light generated by the explosion of a star. They looked at a high-energy photon and a low-energy photon, and essentially it was a race. They knew or believed it was emitted at the same time about 7 billion years ago, and then they were detected by an Earth-orbiting telescope called Fermi. And you know what? This high-energy photon and the much lower-energy one arrived with almost a dead heat, like within about a hundredth of a second of each other. So according to this, that graininess, if it is there, did not disturb the light. Maybe graininess is the wrong idea, or maybe quantum gravity doesn't somehow become important to a smaller scale size, a smaller grain size than we might have thought. And it's just it's a beginning of a way to get at this. When I talk about graininess, this is like a trillionth the size of a hydrogen atom. I'm talking really small. And it's kind of amazing that this cosmic race across halfway of the universe can start to say something about this stuff.
So theory wins one today and theory loses one today.
That might be possible. Yes.
As I think Steven Weinberg once said, physics doesn't care what scientists want.
That's right.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for being with us today. Ron Cowan is a freelance science writer for Nature and Science, among others, and you can find links to his stories from that meeting there at sciencefriday.com. Speaking of dark matter and space-time, one of the major questions about our universe is, how did it all come into being? And my next guest tackles that question in his new book, A Universe from Nothing: Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. Lawrence Krauss is also a foundation professor and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University in Tempe. He's also in our NPR Washington studios. Welcome back, Lawrence.
It's always good to be back, Ira.
What about this graininess stuff? You were listening to that. What do you think about that experiment?
Well, that was a speculative idea, and most speculative ideas are wrong, and that's why it takes a while to make progress. And so, I wouldn't call it a failure for theory. It's one of the most exciting, or two of the most exciting states to be in if you're a theorist, are either wrong or confused.
Speaking of which, I'm sure you're going to leave us in an enlightened situation state that by the time you're done today talking about your book. The title of your book, give us a thumbnail sketch of how you get something from nothing.
Well, the title of the book, A Universe from Nothing and Why There's Something Rather Than Nothing, deals with this question that's been around for as long as people have really started to ask questions about the universe, and is really at the heart of a lot of the world's religions. Why is there something rather than nothing? If we live in a universe full of stuff. How did it get here? And many people think that very question implies the need for a creator. But what's truly been amazing, and what the book's about, is the revolutionary developments in both cosmology and particle physics over the past 30 or 40 years that have not only changed completely the way we think about the universe, but made it clear that there's a plausible case for understanding precisely how a universe full of stuff, like the universe we live in, could result literally from nothing by natural processes. And while it's a little pretentious, I'll be pretentious anyway, the idea, I think, is similar to, if you think about it, to the origin of life and to Darwin's demonstration that life, which appears to be designed here on Earth, the diversity of life, can actually arise. That diversity can arise by natural causes. And we don't yet know the true origin of life, but we think we'll understand it by chemistry. And what we're discovering is that, in fact, physics has suggested that maybe the same is true for the whole universe, that we don't need a creator. And I guess most importantly, that the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is really a scientific question, not a religious or philosophical question, because both nothing and something are scientific concepts, and our discoveries over the past 30 years have completely changed what we mean by nothing. In particular, nothing is unstable. Nothing can create something all the time due to the laws of quantum mechanics, and it's unbelievable. It's fascinatingly interesting. And what I wanted to do was use the hook of this question, which I think, as I say, is provoked religious people as well as scientists to encourage people to try and understand the amazing universe that we actually live in.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Lawrence Krauss, author of a new book which talks about how the universe began, where it's heading, how we got here, all that kind of stuff. A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. And if you'd like to ask Lawrence a question and get in on the conversation, maybe you have a question about how the universe is working. As I say, our number is 1-800-989-8255. Tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Go to our Facebook page at Sci/SciFry and our website at sciencefriday.com. We'll take all of your questions and put them all together and ask Lawrence to talk about them. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, SciFry fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFry iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFry Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFry BE app. That's the SciFry BE app. Download and enjoy. You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking with Lawrence Krauss, who is author of Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. He's also foundation professor and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University in Tempe. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You said that the physics has changed, what we know about the universe has changed so much dramatically over the last few years, especially the idea that what we think of empty space is really not empty, correct?
That's exactly right. Empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles that pop in and out of existence in a timescale so short that you can't even measure them. Now, that sounds, of course, like counting angels on the head of a pin. If you can't measure them, then it doesn't sound like it's science. But in fact, you can't measure them directly. but we can measure their effects indirectly. These particles that are popping in and out of existence actually affect the properties of atoms and nuclei and actually are responsible for most of the mass inside your body. And in fact, really one of the things that motivated this book was the most profound discovery in recent times, and you even alluded to it in the last segment, the discovery that most of the energy of the universe actually resides in empty space. You take space, get rid of all the particles, all the radiation, and it actually carries energy. And that notion that in fact, empty space, once you allow gravity into the game, what seems impossible is possible. It sounds like it would violate the conservation of energy for you to start with nothing and end up with lots of stuff. But the great thing about gravity is it's a little trickier. Gravity allows positive energy and negative energy. And out of nothing, you can create positive energy particles. And as long as a gravitational attraction produces enough negative energy, the sum of their energy can be zero. And in fact, when we look out at the universe and try and measure its total energy, we come up with zero. I like to think of it as the difference between, a savvy stockbroker and an embezzler. A savvy stockbroker will buy stocks on margin with more money than they have, and as long as they get that money back in there before anyone notices, and in fact, if the stocks go up, they end up with money where they didn't have any before, whereas the embezzler, of course, is discovered. Well, the universe is a savvy stockbroker. It can borrow energy, and if there's no gravity, it gets rid of it back before anyone notices, but if gravity is there, it can actually create stuff where there was none before, and you can actually create enough stuff to account for everything we see in the universe. But, you know, it's more than that, because some people would say, and I've had this discussion with theologians and others, well, you know, just empty space isn't nothing. You know, there's space. How did the space get there? But the amazing thing is, once you apply, in fact, quantum mechanics to gravity, as you were beginning to allude again in the last segment, then it's possible, in fact, it's implied that space itself can be created where there was nothing before, that literally whole universes can pop out of nothing by the laws of quantum mechanics. And in fact, the question, why is there something rather than nothing, then becomes sort of trite, because nothing is unstable. It will always produce something. The more interesting or surprising question might be, why is there nothing? But of course, if we ask that question, well, we wouldn't be here if that was true.
1-800-989-8255. In your book, you talk about dialing backwards. First, the idea that the universe is expanding at greater than the speed of light. Is that correct? Still expanding?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the discovery of this dark energy has told us that the future will be quite different than we thought. And it's one of the things I talk about in the book. Because of this dark energy, this energy of empty space, which is gravitationally repulsive, it's causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate, to speed up. In fact, the discovery of that was awarded this year's Nobel Prize. But if you think about what that implies for the future, distant galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster. And eventually, they indeed will all be moving away from us faster than the speed of light, which is allowed in general relativity, and we won't see them. And the universe in the far future will be cold and dark and empty. So in fact, as my late friend Christopher Hitchens, who was writing the foreword for the book before he passed away, used to say, nothing is heading towards us as fast as it can. So another answer to the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is just wait.
and of course, we're getting questions already. Here's a tweet from Maggie Kelly. He says, so if space is infinitely expanding, what is it expanding into?
Well, that's a good question. It's a question people often ask. And the answer is it doesn't need to expand into anything. The only two ways I know to try and explain this, well, the simplest way perhaps is to think of a rubber bedsheet that's infinitely big. Now stretch it. It's now bigger, but it wasn't expanding into anything because it was already infinitely big. Now, if you don't like infinities, and there's a good reason to not be comfortable with infinities, just think of a balloon. And of course, when you blow up a balloon, you think it's expanding into the room. But that's because you've embedded this two-dimensional surface of a balloon into this three-dimensional space. But if the two-dimensional surface of the balloon was all there was, as it expanded, the balloon would get bigger, and every dot on that balloon, if you painted dots on that balloon, would move away from every other dot, but it wouldn't be expanding into anything. It would just be getting bigger. So our universe, in fact, doesn't need to expand into anything. Space can expand on its own, whether the universe is finite or infinite, without boundary and without expanding into anything.
Let's go to Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I'll make it quick. I was just wondering if are some of the ideas being investigated in space-time recently in terms of the Higgs field and the Higgs boson, Are these in some way kind of a revisiting of the idea of a luminiferous ether that they used to talk about? I know there's differences, but is this kind of ether revisited now?
Well, that's a good question. In a kind of philosophical sense, yes. Both the Higgs field and this dark energy that's permeating everything are indeed permeating empty space, and in that sense, empty space has properties that you would not otherwise imagine, just like they used to imagine as an ether. Of course, the difference was the ether was thought to be necessary to propagate light, and it was also thought to create a special frame of reference, and neither of these things do that. So neither of these things are the ether, but in a philosophical sense, they hearken back to the idea that empty space is full of something.
1-800-989-8255. You mentioned in your book that we are lucky to be living in this time in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, for a variety of reasons. One is, in the far future, and by the far future I mean hundreds of billions of years, astronomers and radio hosts on planets around other stars will look out at the universe, and what they'll see is the universe we thought we lived in 100 years ago. All of the other galaxies will have disappeared except for our own, and people will assume, or beings will assume, they live in a universe that's basically infinite, dark, and empty except for one galaxy with no evidence of the Big Bang. So we're living at this rare cosmic instant in which we're lucky enough to observe the Big Bang. By cosmic instant, I mean a few hundred billion years, but in a cosmic sense, that's an instant. And so we're fortunate to be able to see that. At the same time, of course, it should give us some cosmic humility, because it indicates something that's very important to realize. When you're talking about the whole universe, we're limited by what we can see, because science is an empirical discipline, and we have to be able, and the universe continues to surprise us, and it only can surprise us if we can measure it. And we're stuck in one universe, and we're stuck at the time we live in, 13.72 billion years after the Big Bang, and maybe a lot earlier we might have been able to discover other things, or a lot later, but we are fascinatingly lucky at this point to be able to see the evidence of the Big Bang. And moreover, in an even a grander sense, when one talks about a universe that could easily have come into existence by accident, I even show how current theories suggest maybe even the laws of physics themselves came into being by accident, with no purpose, no design, you might get depressed. But from my point of view, it's really exciting and should energize us, because it suggests that we're unbelievably fortunate that we happen to live in a universe that not only supports life, but that consciousness has evolved and we can appreciate this remarkable universe around us, and we should make the moment most of our brief moment in the sun. We should provide the meaning of the universe and in the meaning of our own lives. So I think science doesn't necessarily have to get in the way of kind of spiritual fulfillment. In fact, I would argue the real story of the universe is far more interesting than any myths or fairy tales that people wrote thousands of years before they even knew the Earth went around the sun.
And we're talking to Lawrence Krauss, author of A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. Let's go to John in Salt Lake City. Hi, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just had a comment. I thought maybe it'd be a better idea to call it God's glue rather than dark matter. Just a comment. Thanks.
All right.
Well, you hearken back to the statement of Steve Weinberg, which is really true. I put it a slightly different way. The universe is the way it is, whether you like it or not, and you can call it whatever you want. But scientists might want something, and religious people might want something too. And I think the great difference and the great wonder of science is that our faith is shakable, not unshakable. That if we discover the universe isn't the way we wanted it to be, well, too bad. In fact, we learn to like it even better.
1-800-989-8255. Gary in Groveland, California. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
With all due respect, and I find what you're saying fascinating, but where is the practicality for us on Earth? What is it doing for us today or even in the very near future?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and I'd put it back to you. I'd say, well, what does a Bach cantata or a Picasso painting do for us? I think the point is we are human beings, and one of the most wonderful aspects of being human beings is being creative and asking questions and trying to understand our place in the universe. And it is absolutely true that understanding the beginning and end of the universe is not going to produce a better toaster. But I'm always amazed that people, for me, one of the great virtues of science is it's a cultural activity, like art and literature and music. It enhances the experience of being human, and it addresses the questions that I'm sure you've asked about your own existence. And if we can get new insights into our own existence and our place in the cosmos, well, that's what happens when we attend a good play or see a good painting. It gives us a new perspective of our place in the universe. And I happen to think that is worth it for its own sake. Plus, I happen to think these ideas are among the most remarkable and astounding ideas human beings have ever come up with. And we owe it to, we scientists owe it to people to try and explain what's happening. And I think they enhance the quality of our existence. You know, it's not just technology. I think that's mm-hmm. what's really important. Now, of course, there are always side benefits of every time we build a new big machine like the Large Hadron Collider and push the limits of technology, we develop tools that later on are used in society. But I don't think we should justify this remarkable adventure just because of the side effects.
1-800-989-8255 is a number here. A tweet from Nate Koch says, would there theoretically be no time if there were no matter or energy?
It's a very good question. Of course, the answer is we don't know, but we do know that space and time are related to matter and energy in general relativity. And we cannot follow the laws of physics back to T equals zero because we don't have a full theory of quantum gravity. But it is quite possible, and indeed quite plausible, that time itself arose just as space arose. And there was no concept of time. It's something that arose as the world became classical. So it could be that the question, what happened before the Big Bang, is not even a good question, because before had no meaning. Hmm. It's not necessarily the case, because we really don't know. We are at the limits of our knowledge. And I guess that's something I want to stress for people who think, you know, I don't want to claim that we know the universe came from nothing. What is amazing is that we can see plausible mechanisms by which that happened. And I find that development truly astounding and remarkable and worth celebrating.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Lawrence Krauss, author of A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. Let's go to Ben's Red in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, if we don't understand the essence of the sun shining, I mean, why the sun even shines, why the earth rotates, why do we assume there's no creator? Because it's kind of interesting the sun would shine every day and we keep rotating on the axis. There's a reason for all that. The fact we don't understand it doesn't make us, that should not allow us to say there's no creator. It's kind of, we don't have an answer and we're assuming because maybe we are failing in trying to get an explanation to our existence. So I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, thanks.
Well, you know, look, I think the point is, often, by the way, when we ask why questions, what we really mean is how. We don't really mean why. If we ask why are there 9 planets or 8 planets, if you get rid of Pluto, which I'll never do, we really mean, how did those planets form? And what's remarkable is to try and understand how the universe evolved. And that's what science tries to do, not really. And when we ask why does the sun shine, what we really mean is what are the processes that cause the sun to shine? And one of the truly great and remarkable developments of the 20th century, which again is worth celebrating, is that we understand the processes that actually power the sun. We do understand how the sun shines, or if you wish, why the sun shines. We've discovered nuclear energy. We've discovered that if you have a collapsing gas and it heats up, that nuclear reactions will produce an object that will burn brightly for 10 billion years, and we can actually predict its structure and compare it with observation. And that is amazing, that without ever having been inside the sun, we now know how the sun works. Those things are worth celebrating. And if you say, well, look, you don't need someone inside the sun, some divine intelligence constantly producing energy, I don't think that diminishes the universe. It's as Richard Feynman used to say, you know, just if you understand how a rainbow works, it doesn't make it any less magnificent. It makes it more magnificent. And if it means that we don't need an intelligence intervening every day in our lives, I happen to think that makes the universe actually even more fascinating.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. What about the idea of a multiverse, that there are infinite numbers of other universes around?
Well, you know, that's something I deal with at the end of the book, because it's, you know, it's not a concept that I'm particularly fond of, but we seem to be driven there by our theories. And it does suggest the last bit, because some people, indeed, when I debate this question of nothingness, they say, well, look, you can get rid of space. You can get rid of stuff in space, the first kind of nothing. You can even get rid of space, but you still have the laws. Who created the laws? Well, it turns out that we've been driven both from ideas from cosmology, from a theory called inflation, or even string theory that suggests there may be extra dimensions, to the possibility that our universe isn't unique, and moreover, that the laws of physics in our universe may just be accidental. They may have arisen spontaneously, and they don't have to be the way they are, but if they were any different, we wouldn't be here to ask the question. It's called the anthropic idea, and it may be right. It's not an idea I find very attractive, but it may be right, and if it is, then it suggests that even the very laws themselves are not fundamental. They arose spontaneously in our universe, and they're very different in other universes, and in some sense, if you wish, the multiverse plays the role of what you might call a prime mover or a god. It exists outside of our universe. And some people said, well, you know, physicists have just created this multiverse because they want to get rid of God. Nothing could be further from the truth. The multiverse, we've been driven to it by our discoveries in cosmology and particle physics. We've been driven to that possibility, which seems plausible and maybe even likely. And if as a corollary, it allows for our universe to be spontaneously created and even the laws created, well, that's okay. But we weren't driven there because of some philosophical prejudice against a creator. That didn't even enter into the discussion.
All right, Lawrence. Thank you very much. You're always short of words, as usual. It's always great. Always great to see you. Great to have us. Lawrence Krauss's new book, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. You're getting even better as a writer. I mean, my standard is George Gamow, and you've come very close to him as a writer in this book. So,
well, that's a great compliment. Thank you very much.
Terrific, easy read on this book. A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing, Lawrence Krauss. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about tuberculosis and a strain that's not only drug-resistant, it's invincible. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away.
If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've talked many times about the rise of drug-resistant bacteria, germs that resist most antibiotics except for a precious few. A case in point is tuberculosis. But now comes word of a strain of TB that is totally drug-resistant. TDR-TB, as doctors are calling it. There are no second-choice antibiotics here. We simply have no drugs to fight this superbug. There are no weapons left, and it has now infected a dozen patients in India. How did this strain originate? And if our drugs don't work anymore, what can doctors do, if anything? And what kind of threat does it pose to us or the rest of the people around the world? Here to talk about it is Marion McKenna. She is the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. She also writes the Superbug blog for Wired, where this story appeared. She joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Marion, tell us about this. It sounds pretty scary, this new superbug.
You know, I have to say I find this chilling, and it's a little complicated. The way this came to light is that immediately before Christmas, so almost everyone missed it at the time, including me, a couple of physicians in Mumbai wrote a letter to a medical journal describing four patients they have with what they called totally drug-resistant TB, which means, as you said, that none of the first-line drugs and none of the second-line drugs, that's more than a dozen drugs altogether, nothing worked. These people had just were incurable. The Indian media jumped on this story and got the hospital to admit that there actually were 12 patients. They just happened to have complete histories for four. Now, over the next couple of days, it turns out that TDR-TB was actually seen before in 2009 in 15 patients in Iran. I've spoken to the Iranian physicians. No one's quite sure what happened to those folks. And there were also two cases in Italy who both died in 2003. So it's clearly been popping up for a while, but it looks like this Indian cluster is the one that may be the best documented, and it's certainly the one causing the most concern.
Marion, do we know how this originated or how it started?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the problem. When we talk about antibiotic resistance, and as you and I have talked before, there are all kinds of things that can contribute to that. Misuse of antibiotics in agriculture, misuse in sort of everyday medicine. What's going on here with this TB very clearly is that it's an artifact created by poor medical care and poor use of drugs. These people in India, at least, and certainly in the other cases, were not correctly diagnosed to start with. They were given the wrong drugs. They weren't given the right length of drugs. And even at the best of times, MDR-TB, or highly resistant TB, is difficult to treat. And they were sort of kind of natural laboratories for the emergence of a totally resistant strain.
So how fearful should we be that this strain will permeate around the world?
So, you know, this is a sort of plus-minus proposition, because on the one hand, it's really troubling to have something like this because we live in such a globalized society where people move back and forth from the industrialized world to the developing world through different economies, and diagnostic tools for TB are really not good. So you might think that someone has everyday TB and they might have a resistant form. The other side of that is that TB is not that easy to catch. It's not like measles. You don't catch TB by just walking past someone on the street. You have to be in close contact with them. But I'll say the third thing that really makes my jaw drop is that literally as I was waiting for this phone line to come live, a bulletin moved across the wire that there were two more cases of TDR-TB in another hospital in a different part of India. They were being held in confinement in the hospital, and one of them has gone missing.
One of the patients has gone missing?
One of the patients has skipped out, probably understandably, because these drugs are not pleasant to take, and they cause a lot of side effects. You have to take them for a very long time, and it's probably not very pleasant being treated as a public health criminal. So one of these patients has checked himself out of the hospital and disappeared.
So we don't know where that... An infectious patient with the strain of totally drug-resistant TB...
Correct.
...is missing. Wow. What would we do in this country? What are they doing in India to find that person or to stop it from spreading?
Well, I think the Indian government is really kind of struggling with this, and it must be said that the media in India have really jumped on this story and are really pushing it forward, which I think is just fantastic, because of course, as has been seen in other countries with other profound infectious diseases, there's a lot of stigma associated with a situation like this where your country suddenly gets identified with a deadly disease. So the Indian media are pushing the government to try to articulate its plans, but the reality is India is a pretty under-resourced society when it comes particularly to healthcare because of the size of its population and the differential between the rich and the poor. It does not have the diagnostic tools that are needed. It's actually quite difficult to diagnose resistant TB as opposed to plain TB.
So what do you do to treat these people? Or is it back to the old sanitarium pre-antibiotic days? You put people out, isolate them, quarantine them, and hope they get better?
Well, if you think back a couple of years ago, when people started to be concerned about MDR-TB, that's TB resistant just to the first-line drugs, there were a couple of cases that came into the United States, and public health authorities held them essentially in isolation. That what's supposed to happen is that until you are deemed non-infectious while you've been in drug treatment, if you have one of these highly infectious, highly resistant forms, you are supposed to be confined in some manner. But, you know, if you asked a public health person, do we have enough isolation rooms and hospitals in this country to contain a major epidemic, we already know from worrying about highly infectious flu that we don't have enough isolation rooms. We certainly don't have enough to contain a major TB epidemic.
So everybody's going to be watching to see if this spreads, and in the meantime, the Indian government will be looking for this missing patient.
I think that people are really concerned about what happens next, because as one of the physicians who brought this to light to start with a couple of days ago admitted, what they have identified is just the tip of the iceberg, and really no one is sure how big the rest of that iceberg is.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get a quick question in from a listener. Let's go to Jared in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Jared.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a documentary some time ago about the Soviet bacteriophage program, where they cultured different bacteriophages that would specifically attack different disease-causing bacteria. It appeared that that program really shut down with the fall of the Soviet Union, but I was wondering if that technology still offers any promise for treatment.
So that's a really interesting question. A couple of things within that. The first is that the FOSH program did not completely shut down, though it ceased to be state-supported. And I believe there's still a FOSH program in the state of Georgia, not the state of Georgia I'm sitting in, but the state of Georgia in the former Soviet Union. But whether FOSHs are effective against tuberculosis is something I really know nothing about.
But it's an interesting question, Jared, about using FOSHs, because there's a phage for every kind of bacteria, isn't there?
That's what the documentary indicated, and I was wondering if that was a possibility in this case.
All right. That's an interesting possibility. Thanks for calling. 1-800-999-8255. So how do we wrap up this story? Is this a hopeful story, Marin, or are we just fearful now?
I think it's reasonable to be fearful. I don't think we should be panicked. I think we should be paying attention to the lessons that are embedded within this story. There are a couple of them. The first is the sort of one of my favorite themes, which is where are the new drugs? Because the reason that we're so scared about highly drug-resistant TB is because there's no new drug coming along. The drugs that we rely on for TB control, in fact, a lot of bacterial control these days are about 50 years old because it's not cost-effective for pharmaceutical companies to make antibiotics. The second is we have to be aware that we need much better diagnostic tools. You know, it can take weeks to grow TB out in culture to figure out if it's susceptible, but there are some new diagnostic techniques, molecular diagnostic techniques, that could help and make that faster if developing world economies could afford them. And the third is we just have to be aware that really we're all vulnerable at any time. Borders don't protect us. These kind of diseases move back and forth across borders without being detected. And we're really only, as so many public health authorities always say, we're only a plane ride away from anything.
Mm. All right. Thank you, Marin.
Thank you.
Marin McKenna is author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. She also writes the Superbug blog for Wired, where you can find this story, and it first appeared, and then she joined us by phone. Flora Lichtman is here with a video pick of the week, and it's something about an everyday object?
An everyday item. The video pick of the week this week is about... Oh, that was really bad. I tried to do a sound effect. Oh, live radio. Sorry. That was a very weak...
You need a fresh bottle.
I did shake it up before I came in. All right, anyway. Sorry, forget it. Let's reverse. It's about bubbles.
Well, want me to be
there.
There you go.
We don't need this bottle of seltzer. Defective bottle of seltzer. Okay. So the video pick this week is about bubbles being used for something that really surprised me. I'll never look at seltzer the same way. This guy, Manu Prakash at Stanford, says that you can use bubbles to make a computer.
A computer out of bubbles.
A computer of bubbles.
Bubbles computing.
Bubbles can do computations.
Wow.
I learned. This is like a real make your hair hurt kind of subject for me anyway. It took a lot of deep thinking to wrap my head around it, but here's how Manu walked me through it. So hopefully we can explain it. He says that the basic concept is this: to do any kind of computation, and Richard and Feynman has talked about this, and he explained this to me too, that you need a physical something to represent computation. So chalk on a chalkboard.
Fingers.
Yeah,
digits.
Fingers. That's the one I generally use. And in computers, it's usually electrons running through wires, right? So if you could take an analog to that and say bubbles going through tubes could be used the same way that electrons are used for computations in computers.
Right.
And the critical point here is that bubbles interact with each other through the environment. You need this to make, so it's not just bubbles going down a tube, but if two bubbles are near each other, their behavior changes. In other words, one bubble goes through a tube and they're all going to go down the right path, let's say.
They're making a decision.
They make a decision when another bubble is present. They go down the other path. And with that, you can make these and, or, and not gates.
Computer logic. The bubbles make that decision.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Talking about bubbles on Science Friday from NPR. And your video, which you made, shows the actual computer with the tiny little bubbles running through these little pipes?
These little circuits, yeah, these tiny little tubes.
And so, because we live in the world of binary, of ones and zeros, if you have a bubble, that's a one.
Correct.
If you don't have a bubble?
That is a zero. So you can make these sort of basic building blocks of computers is what this researcher showed. And he actually has videos of these adorable little bubbles going through lots of different tubes, a ring oscillator, if that means anything to you. You can see bubbles doing that and gates and stuff like that. So you can actually watch them going through.
On our video pick of the week up there on our website, the bubble computer, it's fascinating. To watch the bubbles go through these little tubes, and they're all spaced out quite evenly in the tubes, and they go through little mazes and touch each other and push each other around.
And you might be thinking, you know, well, why? Bubbles obviously are a lot slower than electrons.
A little bit.
So you're not going to be doing like your iPhone, you know, yelping from your bubble computer. And they're really big compared to electrons, but they have this added advantage that electrons don't have. They're like little teeny tiny test tubes. They can carry things with them. So the thing that excites Manu Prakash about this work is that you could actually have them physically transport things while they're doing a computation. So create as you compute. It's like a two-for-one deal.
Wow. Well, that's kind of interesting. And not only is the concept terrific, but the video, our pick of the week, is beautifully shot with the bubbles. I mean, you have some great photos of you know, you look at the bubbles on the, was it a, it is a whiskey shot glass that you have there or something?
It's a little glass.
And the bubbles, because you're using it so close up, watch them jump around.
I
love listening to, but I was so distracted by just the bubbles jumping around on the glass.
Yeah, it is really beautiful. I looking at bubbles through a macro lens, I felt like I could have done this for hours. They like stick to the glass and they move very quickly when they explode. So it is fun to watch. It was fun to shoot.
Maybe we should do more of these tiny little macros.
Yeah, if you have suggestions for tiny things you'd like to see, we were talking about maybe how the eye responds to when you turn the light on and off. You were saying there's something in your house that you wanted to see.
I want to water my orchids. I watched the water. Actually, a big bubble, a drop will be on the roots, and I can watch it shrink over in real time as the root sucks in the water, you know?
Well, that sounds like one for next week.
So maybe you were talking about maybe cream and coffee swirling. There's a certain pattern that takes.
Yeah. I think actually there's research on that. I'll have to look into that. But yeah, I think the macro lens, I never get bored with that kind of stuff.
And there's bubbles in beer. We've done stories on Guinness actually creates, and the Guinness stout creates a whole actually convection current of bubbles going up and down.
Yeah, those bubbles go down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Richard Zare, is it? I think he was on our show years ago talking about, he actually studied this and made films out of it. So.
This is sort of what I love. And also for this video this week, Manu Prakash said that he got this idea to make this bubble computer when he was in the subway. So he's sitting in the subway and he's looking at the subway map. And you'll see if you look at the video, it looks very similar to the circuits he made. And he thought, you know, hey, he's studying fluids. He was at MIT. And he thought, I wonder if you could do this. So, you know, inspiration is everywhere.
And as they say in Great Britain, it's the tube, right?
Which is it's the tube,
right? It's the tube, which is what he made with his bubble.
Yeah, absolutely.
The tube. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ara.
Our video pick of the week up there on our website, Bubbles. It's really cute. If you just want to watch the bubbles for nothing else, it's just a great watch on our website at sciencefriday.com. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.